Welcome to Blind Level Tech. This isn't just accessible tech talk. This is technology on a whole new level. We're showing you just how possible it is to live the life you want.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Blind Level Tech. I am your host, Evan Stons, and I hope you have enjoyed all of the episodes that we've been putting out. We have been just cranking it out with the interviews. I feel like we had a bit of a quiet period of time, you know, in February, March. Like I always say, you know, it's usually when kind of guests start to thin out a little bit and, you know, you have to get a bit more creative with ideas and, but, you know, yeah, we've had an influx of guests and it's been quite exciting for me as far as just getting to know and connect with people that I, you know, might not have known otherwise. But today's guest is actually somebody that I have, well, I touched base in a way with a company that he actually helped co-found like years ago when I was in eighth grade. And we'll definitely talk about that just a little bit here later on. But today I am joined by Austin Serafin, and we're going to just kind of have a fun little, you know, easygoing conversation because Austin is one of those guests that we've already been talking for almost half an hour at this point. We could probably make like 4 or 5 hour long episodes just by ourselves. But he's an amateur radio operator, an accessibility consultant, and also one of the co-founders of an organization that was, it was called Philly Touch Tours. And we'll talk about that too, but welcome to Blind Level Tech, Austin. I know we've already been talking a bit, so it, you know, a little weird to kind of circle back around, but it's good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I know. Yeah, we were talking. I said, I thought this was the episode.
Right.
So here we are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well,
it's great to be here.
I love chronological order and kind of, you know, just going through, you know, someone's history, of course, before we get into the, you know, meat and potatoes, of course. So you were born, you know, totally, well, with retinopathy prematurity, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at a pretty young age, you got, you pretty much were into computers from a very young age and got to experience a lot of stuff that I kind of myself wish I got to experience. But how did you, you know, start out with computers, you know, the Apple II and the Echo and all that?
Yeah. I was 7. I was going to St. Lucie's School for the Blind here in Philadelphia. And I guess my family decided it would be good to get a computer.
Yeah, because they had a business. Family,
yeah, we had a family business and they got the Unisys mini, you know, the Unisys. They were
those things are so
terminals.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were terminals that would wire into a central machine. But back in the 80s, this was a big deal. And so they saw that potential and they could see where things were headed. So we looked at some different computers and we got the Apple IIe, and it wasn't like getting a Mac or something now that comes with it. Back then you had to get a separate card and custom software, custom screen reader. And yeah, it was the Echo 2. Yeah. Yeah. From Street Electronics and Text Talker. And Apple DOS 3.3, and I just took to it right away. It's strange the way it happened, actually. I mean, I was already just immediately into it, and I was already playing with radios. I think my first memory might be playing with a radio, actually, if you really want to go further back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I would have had to have been less than 2 because of where we were, and I found this box with buttons and I pressed it and it went ee, and I think it was a clock radio or something, but I was just like, what is this thing? Like something drew me to it. And so, yeah, so I was already starting to like tinker with radios and some electronics. I had one of those 116 one project kits from Radio Shack.
Yeah, those were so cool.
Yeah, and my mom put Braille labels on the different springs of the components, so I started learning. So I was already starting to get into this stuff, and already also really getting into math also. And so we got the Apple, and you know, my mom had to put in the card, which, you know, for a non-tech person, you know, it was like this whole new thing. And she and our friend Kristen, and I think probably one of the nuns from the school all figured it out. And I just remember just encouraging them and being like, you can do it. And they did.
That's
and it
awesome.
Came up and it talked. And I was just like, this is really cool. So the Apple, I think one of the great things about that machine is that it had the basic programming language
built into
the
ROM.
Machine itself. Yeah, it was built into ROM, really. So it had this easy to learn programming language built in. But I didn't have any books or anything like that. I mean, this, you know, it's not like now. Like now they have stuff for kids. I'm so happy. My 9-year-old nephew wants to get into programming.
Oh, yes.
All this. I know. I'm so happy. I'm like, yes.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, but back then we didn't have anything. And I remember just trying commands. I only knew like catalog would give you a list of files on the disk, and then run would run a file. And that was about all I knew. And I remember I played the Eliza game. It was supposed to be like a computer psychotherapist, a computer therapist.
Yeah.
Very early, you know, this was like one of the early experiments in pattern text matching that was done. So it was a fun thing, but it was, you know, really innovative. It was originally made, I think, in like the 70s. It's interesting that we've circled back now. Now we're talking about AI therapists and things. So that debate has totally circled around and taken off, but I'm getting way ahead. So I ran Eliza and was playing it. And I was trying different commands. I didn't know what to do. And I, for some reason, just the thought occurred to me to type list. And I was like, I don't know, maybe it'll list the commands that I can do. But instead, what it did was starting listing out the source code to Eliza.
Yes.
And it'd be like, you know, 10 print welcome to Eliza or whatever. And it just clicked in my head. And I was like, wait, this is how you program. Like, this is what they're talking about. When the adults say that these machines are just following instructions.
Those are the instructions.
These are the instructions that they follow. And it just clicked. And I was like, I can make this magic box do whatever I want. I just have to learn how to give it these instructions. And I was just like, I just knew it. I was seven, but I just knew it. I was like, this is it. Like, this
yeah.
is really cool. So yeah, I think that's why I'm so into like open source and open design, because that's really what started me programming. I wouldn't have been able to do that with a proprietary system, but it was, you know, BASIC was right there. It was just, the code was just right there. And I was just like, this is so neat.
And that's how a lot of programmers got into programming, was BASIC.
Mm-hmm.
Usually,
oh, yeah.
you know, Commodore BASIC or Microsoft Visual or Microsoft BASIC, not Visual BASIC. We're not talking about Visual. That's gross. My own thoughts
but
on that.
But yeah, Microsoft BASIC. And yeah, and then yeah, when MS-DOS came along,
mm-hmm.
There was the Microsoft BASIC, the
and Apple
GW and, BASIC and Q BASIC, huh?
Apple and Microsoft were working a lot more together like back in those days too,
and
the 2GS.
Yeah.
Like you could actually run DOS on your Apple 2GS.
Wow, really? I never did that.
I think the only reason I keep bringing up the 2GS is because it has the Ensoniq sound chip, which was
mm-hmm.
one of the first of its kind, in at least in the Apple world, to be able to do MIDI synthesis and actually do like sampling. And it could do some sort of rudimentary text-to-speech. I actually was on Mastodon a couple of days ago and saw a demo of it. It was a kid writer kind of a program for like, you know, you're one of those basic text talking things. You write something, the computer speaks it when you push enter, but
mm-hmm.
it used the built-in sound chip on the computer. So that probably was kind of like SAM, the software automatic mouth, like one of the first ever versions of like software generated text to speech. We're getting very into the weeds though with that, and I knew that was going to happen, and I will take the full blame for that because I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, it was great. So yeah, I used the 2E, and then I did, you know, we did get a 2GS. Well, first I upgraded the memory, you know, to show people how far. When I got the 2E, it had 64K of memory, not megs or gigs. And we upgraded it to 128K. Oh my goodness. It was like, I can use floating point numbers that are twice as precise. Like, this is real cool.
Yeah.
And then we got the 2GS, and that was cool. And then I got into, you know, MS-DOS. Remember, I got the first Keynote.
Got a PC. Oh my God, you got a Keynote?
Yeah. The first one, it had MS-DOS 2.11 in the ROM.
Wow.
Forget upgrading, and then I got a PC, and then it took off from there. Yeah,
Jonathan Mosen actually just put out an article about like working with Humanware. I've been trying to like soak up as much assistive tech history as I can.
Cool.
But I guess for those who don't know, what people know of as the Braille Note, you know, now the Braille Note Touch Plus and all that, really started off first as a talking DOS computer, and it was mm-hmm. the Keynote, and then eventually that became the Braille Note, the mm-hmm. Braille Note Classic, and then the PK and all that good stuff kind of followed.
It was the Keynote PC Plus.
Yes. Oh, did that have the same? And then your smart speaker pipes in from the background. That was rude.
And what?
My smart speaker, because I said C-O-M-P-U-T-E-R.
Oh no!
And that's its wake word. But so nowadays you're now a Linux user though, I hear.
Yeah, primarily. Yeah. I use Linux as my main operating system. I've also got Mac and I'm getting a Windows machine going, but
nice.
But yeah, I think as I said, just the whole like open source nature of Linux has always been attractive. I mean, it has its challenges.
Oh, for sure.
But yeah.
You know, trying to develop for it, you know, especially when there's not a lot out there for an open source project. I mean, you know, like NVDA mm-hmm. is open source. It's the screen reader we used, and it's come a long, long way since it came out.
Good.
But what's your favorite? I gotta ask, what's your Linux distro? What you like?
For a long time, I've used Arch Linux, but I've been really getting into Slint 64, which is it derives from Salix, which derives from Slackware. I really like Slackware, the Slackware distributions, just because they're so old school. They still use the old RC scripts.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simple.
Easier to work with, less gimmicky features and
stuff.
Because Arch is always, I like Arch. I mean,
Arch is cool.
That's right. I feel like it's a good way to, if you've ever been curious about learning the command line and actually getting, it's just a great way to jump in. Even just dumping, you know, getting something onto a Raspberry Pi with, you know,
mm-hmm.
With like Emacs Speak and all that.
Arch is cool. It's a rolling release, so you'll always be getting the most recent versions of things, which
that's true.
Can be a mixed blessing. It can be good, but it can also introduce problems. But yeah, I mean, Arch is a good accessible distribution, and they've built accessibility into their main ISO, which is awesome.
That's great. I know.
Yeah,
because I know things like the GUI experience with Linux is still kind of depending on like the desktop environment you go with. I've had the best experiences with Mate, actually.
Yeah, Mate.
Or Mate. Mate. I've heard. Gnome's okay. I don't know, but
yeah, Mate is the one we're still usually using. I know.
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think if you want to get into Linux, just jump straight into the command line fearlessly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
And you're getting...
And of course, for server work, it's the only...
That's the best way to go. Windows Server
is
just...
That is what you... Yeah.
We're using that here. And you're getting to do... You're getting to beta test the BT speak, too. Basically, the modern Braille and speak.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. So the Braille and speak. Yeah. We kind of skipped over that too. That's a really important thing also.
It's huge.
I got the Braille and speak when they came out in 89 or whatever, 88, 89. And I used that thing all the way through college, different iterations of it through at least 2000. I mean, I used that thing constantly. They were amazing machines. Blazy's awesome. You know, I'd call them up as a kid and they would take me seriously and answer my questions. And, you know, they wouldn't just blow me off because I was a kid. So,
yeah,
they've always been great.
It's like a family run business, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then for a while, then they stopped. And I don't know, we kind of entered a kind of a dark age, I think, for a little bit there. And then the iPhone came along and that perked things up.
Yeah.
And now the BT Speak is back and Blazy is back. So that's super great.
That's what blows my mind is that, yeah, like Dean and Brian are still like, still making products. And now they're coming out with a BT Braille. Like,
yes, they are.
I kind of wish they'd gone off of like the Braille Light naming scheme, but you know, that's okay. So it sounds like, it actually sounds like the iPhone actually, when that first came out, was kind of the thing that sort of really well, it definitely changed a lot of the way we interact with tech. And the 3GS was the first one to have voiceover on it.
Mm-hmm.
How did you actually, what was your experience like getting into the iPhone actually?
Yeah. Well, it was really cool. I actually just thought of something we said during the pre-show interview that I want to say too about the Braille and Speak is when I was a kid, my parents really had to fight with the school system to let me even use it in class to take notes.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you use an iPhone and now it's like, now it's just a normal thing. So it's just wild how far you've come. So yes, the iPhone, 2010. I remember a friend of mine, who's also into accessibility, got a Windows phone.
Oh, yes.
And I remember we went to a campfire and she had it there and she was on the internet and we were just like, this is really wild. She's like, we're on the internet. And then we heard about the iPhone and she called me after getting one. She called me and she was just like, you have to get an iPhone. My friend Angie. And she's just like, you have to get an iPhone. And I'm like we were just making fun of this. Like a few days ago, we were talking, we were like, this is so stupid. Like how can a blind person use a touchscreen? You know,
mm-hmm.
Cause you know, and a lot of, you know, a lot of blind tech, you know, it's kind of
the accessibility implementations of it. It's,
yeah,
you can tell if it was designed by the blind or at least with the blind in mind versus just some obligation to make their products accessible. And now it's some, you know, poorly designed implementation of or poorly implemented screen reader or something.
Yeah. So, and that's right. And that all, the accessibility to Apple really started when Steve Jobs came back.
Mm-hmm.
He really pushed for it. And I'm glad. And
me too.
Yeah. So 2010, and it was just like, all right. So I went to the AT&T store and I just immediately was just like, this is incredible. You can use it. I mean, like I used it in the store. And my mom sent me a text message for the first time I could text.
Right. And then you were like, wait, how do I send this? Because, you know, you're typically, you know, when you text from like any other, like a, especially a flip phone, you just hit the send button, but there isn't one. So it throws you off.
Yeah. And mom could see the screen. She said, oh, there's a send button above the P. And she put my finger on it and it says send button. And I was just like, this is really cool. And she got the text and was like, all right, yeah. So it just, and a funny story I like to tell is that night, you know, obviously I couldn't sleep from getting this new technology. Right. And everyone, you know, remember this was back 2010.
Right.
And the App Store was brand new. And Steve Jobs didn't even want an App Store. He did want accessibility, but he didn't want an App Store. But, you know, he was, I guess, cajoled otherwise. But so the App Store was brand new and people were like, oh, you got to get apps. And no one like told me what apps to get, but just I just had to get apps. And so I was thinking about different assistive technology. And I searched for color identifier and one came up. And I downloaded it and I ran it and it started saying black, black, black. And I was just like, oh, here we go again. You know, like you talked about, you know, just another poorly implemented thing. I guess this isn't the next big thing. And then I was like, wait a minute. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning.
It's
all
dark.
My lights are off. because I don't need them. And yeah, sighted people need light to see color. I forgot about that. And I turned on the light and it started naming the colors. And I was just like, this is really cool. So yeah, it went from there. Yeah, and we're talking on an iPad right now, actually.
I was wondering, because the mics are pretty solid.
Good, excellent. Yeah, I'm really happy with this iPad. I have this iPad and Magic Keyboard, and I'm really happy with it. For a number of years, I was really into a language called Ruby Motion for writing apps, and now everyone's using Swift, and It looks like you can even start developing apps right on the iPad.
Yep.
Which is super amazing. So I have to get into that. I've been kind of out of the loop.
I know. I was talking to somebody and they told me, you need to get Swift Playground. You're missing out. Because, I mean, apparently it's a good and also a kind of intuitive, fun way to learn Swift. And they've really made it, like, the thing I like that Apple is trying to do is they're trying to really teach kids, especially at a very young age, how to get into coding and how to make it fun. They're doing all these, like, summer camps and virtual things. They do seem to...
Oh, that's so wonderful.
They want to get people, at least the impression I'm getting is that they want people to be involved and to be developing and, you know, becoming, you know, big thinkers and innovators for these products. And
wow, that's great. I have a 9-year-old nephew and he wants to get into programming. I'm so happy.
Yeah, my 12-year-old cousin wants to get into he's got into Python and was kind of showing me some stuff he was making, which is
fantastic.
It's amazing to watch. I consider myself, I'm more of the hardware geek. I like to take things apart and upgrading the RAM in a server or replacing, that's more my thing. So I think it's a good balance, to have, you know, hardware, software people out there, you know, because got to have somebody to build the hardware to run the software on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Yes.
And didn't you do like a fitness app actually at some point?
Yeah, I did. Yes. There was a neat project called Blind Alive. And I think you can still find the workouts actually on YouTube. But yeah, that was really neat. And I learned all that and people liked the app. So, and there were workouts, there were audio workouts for the blind. Or for anyone, but
they're blind friendly and they're inclusive.
Blind friendly, exactly correct. Yeah.
And actually, speaking of being inclusive, let's talk a little bit. I know it's no longer around, but it left behind a really good legacy and probably a lot of great memories for folks. I want to talk about Philly Touch Tours. And
okay,
I'd first like to start though with my personal story about Philly Touch Tours briefly.
I know, our paths almost crossed.
They did. And it was all because of a letter I'd written a long time ago when I was in eighth grade to Comcast, when I was really happy with their accessibility on their set-top boxes. Mm-hmm. They were happy with the letter, sent me out, and referred me. And so I got to meet Trish, and I got to go to the museum and actually touch stone and, you know, walls and windows and things like that from like over 5,000 years ago. And it was incredible. And it just felt like I was a part of the general experience. It didn't feel like some accommodation was being made. It just kind of, it was so well done. And, I still tell people about those, cause it, it wasn't like, okay, we're just letting you touch this just because, special, this is just like, I got to learn about the history of it, but it was incredible. And so, can we talk about that a little bit?
It's a different way of learning, isn't it?
It is.
To learn, that way. Yeah. I know. I thought about that window recently because my HVAC unit failed during a heat wave here in Philadelphia. And I was like, man, those ancient Egyptians, the window is just like a big square hole.
Yeah.
It's like, man, and they were in a desert. That was their window and they were okay. So, all right.
There you go.
Guess I can tough it out. You made me think back to how I even got into this. Wow. I hadn't thought about this in a long time. I went to an event Oh man, it was an event in Philly. It was a, you know, like a computer meetup.
Ooh.
It might have been, I forget which meetup. I'm sorry. It might have been.
That's okay, but those are fun.
Yeah, it was a meetup in Philadelphia. And at the time I lived there, I'm in the suburbs now, but I went to it and I could probably even look it up if we really wanted to know. But I met a woman there who was going to do a jazz cruise. Oh, not a cruise, but, you know, like a boat thing, a boat tour, you know, for a couple hours. And play jazz, and they describe the surroundings because, you know, Philly has rivers. And,
they have a ton the topography, I guess it'd be.
So there's definitely a bunch of boating around, you know, the waterways. And so I was like, all right, you know, I'll help out. I'll, you know, go to your jazz boat thing. That's cool. So I did with some of my friends, and that's where I met Trish. Trish went on the jazz boat thing. And so we started talking, and she said, oh, you know, I volunteer at the University of Pennsylvania. And, well, I guess she did actually work, I don't know, but, she said, I'm at the University of Pennsylvania doing touch tours of their museum. And she said, no, would you like to go? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll go on your museum touch tour. And we went and touched the things that you did, the Egyptian exhibits.
Right. You get to see like the Sphinx and the.
Yeah. It might have been the other one. I think the Sphinx came later. There were two. And I don't recall touching the Sphinx the first time. But I do recall the Sekhmet statue. There are a few things that I recall. But it was pretty cool. You know, it's neat to touch these old objects. And we were having lunch after, and she said, oh, you know, would you maybe like to become a docent? And I'm like, what's a docent? I don't even know what that is. And so I did, and I started volunteering there. And, it was, you know, Trish and me and some others. And so we were doing those. And then I remember it kind of dawned on us, on me and Trish. And we were like, you know, we can't, you know, there's so many other places around and we need to do all these touch tours, but we can't be everywhere. We can't be at like every museum in Philly all the time giving touch tours. And so we decided to co-found Philly Touch Tours to give these tours at the museums that we were thinking about, and also to train the staff at museums.
On how to be inclusive.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I kind of leapt ahead because first we just co-founded it and we started thinking about doing touch tours at the different museums. And then we realized, hey, we can't be everywhere at once. Let's train the staff at the museums and using the University of Pennsylvania is our model. And Trish really put that together. Her background is in education. So it was really cool. And it was really successful. And we trained a lot of staff. There's so much turnover in the museum world. I learned that they're always moving around. So who knows where some of those people who took those tours our trainings are. I have no idea. They'll probably write in from some far off location. But we trained a bunch of people. And it was pretty neat.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible what, you know, you're able to do with the amount of just people that, you know, need to be just kind of informed on how access is done well. You know, it's just kind of that matter of doing just a little bit of that heavy lifting. And I do feel like that's why, you know, yes, you know, it kind of fell through because of COVID and all that. But I feel like the impact that Philly Touch Tours made, you know, is definitely a very lasting one. So
I'm really glad to hear that. You never really quite know, you know, how what you're doing affects people and affects things have through time. You know, you really don't. But yeah, it was a neat thing to do. Yeah, so something I thought you'd appreciate as a hardware person is one of the neatest experiences I had with Philly Touch Chairs was it was actually with the Sumerian exhibit, which is the oldest stuff they had. The Egyptian stuff, I think, was like 3,000 or 4,000 years old. The Sumerian was like 5,000 or 6,000. And they let us touch a stone chisel and a chalice also. But I remember picking up this chisel and I immediately knew what it was. It really made me think about universal design. Like, I knew what it was. I knew how to use it. I knew its purpose. It was just this old 5,000-year-old chisel.
But the design hadn't really changed. It was.
But the design hadn't changed. Yeah.
Because you go buy a chisel from, you know, Home Depot or whatever, it's probably going to still... it is. It's going to function the same and look the same as that one that was built 5,000 years ago.
Yep.
Because it works universally. When it comes to making products accessible, I mean that can mean a lot of things depending on the product. If it's, you know, if it's a device like, you know, a computer, like a smartphone, a tablet, a calculator, or, you know, just anything that does computations, then, you know, something like a screen reader will definitely be at least the basics. You know, if it's a device like a washing machine or something that has touch buttons, ideally, you know, you want to have tactile markings by those buttons, because it seems like everything nowadays is being made with all these weird flat panel touch sensitive interfaces. And
And even the washing machines now, they have dials, but they're not analog dials. They're just digital controls. So even if you mark it, you still have to keep track of the position.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so that kind of begs the question, why is it important to make things accessible completely from day one, from the ground up?
Yeah. It's like...
it's a loaded question.
It is, yeah, and it's like the same is true like with buildings or anything. If you think about accessibility in the beginning, it's much easier to design it in than to try to retrofit it and go back. You'll be making choices, you know, if you include accessibility in the beginning or don't, that will influence the choices that you're making.
I like your building analogy, actually. And I think we've used this before, like, You're building a multi-story building, and like, let's say you're building a two-story shopping mall, but you build the building and don't put in an elevator. But then, you know, you have a two-story building, and effectively the only way for people to get to the second floor is taking the stairs. And, you know, more and more people start using your mall and moving in, and you get more businesses, and eventually, you know, you kind of have that need of, if you want to have people actually attend, you know, going to your mall and conducting business there, you're going to need to build some sort of accommodation in. And it's a lot more costly to, it would be a lot more costly to install something like an elevator / escalator or anything like that into something that was already built than it would be to just build it in while you're constructing the product from the get-go.
Right. Yep, exactly. And then it's that paradox, because then when you say, hey, can you make yourself accessible? Oh, it costs too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you run into a lot of, companies that are just, that's the reason a lot of companies are trying or aren't making their stuff accessible, is because they do think it costs too much, or they don't have the skills, or they don't know who to talk to as far as making their stuff accessible. Some people don't even know what a screen reader is or how it works. And this is actually kind of one of those things that, looking through, you know, like the rundown, the show notes I have here, when you've developed apps and stuff in the past, one of the best things that at least I've seen is, if you're wanting to make your stuff accessible, use the app or program as if you're not, you know, use it like a person with blindness or low vision with a screen reader.
And adhere to standards. Yeah, the neat thing that Apple did. Firstly, your elevator analogy is also good because it highlights universal design. It accommodates all kinds of groups of people. It's not just like accommodating one group. And the same like with the wheelchair ramps. Like,
right,
we think of them for people in wheelchairs, but they benefit a lot of different groups. But
exactly.
Yeah. So the thing Apple did is they built accessibility right in, like even as far as like to the objects themselves. Accessibility.
It's baked into the core
traits. It's, yeah, I mean, literally, like when you drill down, like to the NS object class, like the root class of all the other object classes, the accessibility stuff is right there, like right at the root object class. So it really is.
And do you think that gives Apple, because the thing that, you know, especially in the blind low vision community, everybody, you know, it feels like the spotlight is almost always on Apple. You know, yes, they were really the first company to make a touchscreen smartphone accessible for the blind. You know, prior to that, we were using stuff like Tox and Mobile Speak and all that on Blackberries and Windows mobile devices and stuff like that. And they're, you know, using keyboards. And would you say Apple, the fact that they've baked accessibility really into the core of their operating systems and the development, you know, the development languages for them, does that put them over, give them an advantage over other companies like Google, Microsoft, et cetera?
Android's come a long way too. TalkBack has gained a lot of features. So that's good. So they do that. They all build the accessibility traits into
the core.
To the object. Yeah.
But it's how it's executed.
Yeah. And like with mobile apps too, like things are so locked down on purpose.
To make things secure, you know.
To make things secure, right. There are a number of reasons. And so because of that, there's like really only one way of when it really comes down to it, of implementing these things. I mean, there are other like frameworks and toolkits on top of it, but when it really comes down to it, they're all being implemented in the same way. So it's easier, I think, to make a really accessible app than it might be like on the web, which is like the Wild West. You know, like there are just so many different frameworks and things. It's just wide open. So it's a whole different thing. So yeah, I do think it's probably easier if a developer is writing the app. Remember in part one, I told that story about the color identifier app.
Yes, that app wasn't even meant for the blind.
That I used, right. And that wasn't even meant for the blind. Exactly right. And the reason why I could use it is because they just wrote it using the standard things that Apple provides, and they just followed the standards, and so it was accessible. That's really cool.
It is. And it actually brings up a point that it's often better to try to kind of go bare bones basic. You know, yes, there are ways to make your program look graphically, you know, however you want it to, without having to use different frameworks or different plugins that might make it less accessible. And I think things like Electron and all that web app, those web app frameworks really are going to introduce some issues, potentially. I'm not sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I get it. They want one code base for multiple platforms. Mm. But yeah, voiceover users, for instance, yeah, we can definitely tell one of those web apps from a native app. It's immediately obvious.
Yeah. Usually it's a lot slower, and you get like weird, you get the navigation controls and stuff at the top and bottom. Mm-hmm. And on PC, you don't get like menu bars as much or.
Oh, right.
The shortcuts are different. It's just.
Yeah.
And response times. They're just not as response. I feel like screen readers already are kind of a bit of a resource hog on your system. And these, at least from my experiences, and really I try to avoid web apps as much as I can, but like messing around with like the new Outlook and stuff, my perfectly capable computer just gets, it slows things down. And so while I am, I'm a little concerned about where we're headed, but I'm also optimistic because of, you know, because of tools and consulting services like yours. You have a consulting service though, and that is definitely something I feel like we ought to highlight.
Yeah. I'm getting it started back up again after a hiatus. I had to focus on my health and
good. I think it's
and move, which was part of that. Yep. Moving out of the city. I'm started back up again, and I'm going to start with mobile and go from there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge thing, and I think go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I think really educating the public on what a screen reader is or what these accessibility tools are and how they work and how they interact with existing devices is really both crucial for advancing accessibility and really highlighting that whole concept of universal design. And it benefits everybody because I feel like if companies just use the tools that are already there to make their software accessible, they don't try to use overlays or they don't.
Oh, yeah. I knew we were going to bring up overlays.
I had to bring up overlays. Yeah. Those are frustrating. I don't like.
They really are.
You want to talk a slap on accessibility kind of thing. Yeah. I feel like that's the worst example of it.
Oh, yeah, totally. Because it's BS, and they're like, fix your accessibility without writing any code. And you're like, I don't even see how that's possible. That doesn't even sound real.
Right. And that's the problem. That is kind of the issue with those. And they also just drastically and unnecessarily change the way that you interact with websites. And so, it's just kind of the point of, use the tools and just try to stick with the bare bone basic stuff, and try to make your software just universally accessible for everybody, regardless of what, how they interact with their devices.
Yeah. And again, talking about benefiting multiple groups, if you have a bare bones basic design, a minimalist design, it benefits blind accessibility, it benefits people on the spectrum, benefits people with learning disabilities, might improve your SEO. There are a lot of advantages to having a good, accessible, minimal design.
Absolutely. How can people find you and the work that you're doing?
You can go to austinserafin.net. That's the best place. I'm building my professional website. That'll probably be .com, but I'll link everything together. I'm getting back on social media. Ham radio is the original social media. Yes. So I haven't really been on social media, but I know I have to, get that back going. I've got my X and Facebook accounts. I'm on a Mastodon for ham radio. I want to get on a tech Mastodon or something, getting my LinkedIn profile back up. But for now, the website's probably the best thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I can't believe how much time the time just went right by. We talked for a half hour before the first interview and I was like, I thought this was it. Like,
no, I was just trying to see, I always try to kind of, feel people out and just see what we can talk about and what information we can cover, what rabbit holes we can go down, because those are fun.
Yeah.
I love them.
Yeah, yeah.
But
thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
My first interview in a number of years. So, and I hope everyone liked it.
I can't imagine this will be the last time we have you on. We're probably going to have to do, I've got some episodes in the can that I've been really wanting to do, including one on getting into amateur radio from a complete novice background. So
yeah, good. Yeah. I got my novice when I was 12. So,
wow. Yep. So we're going to have you on this. Basically, this won't be the last that you guys hear from Austin at all.
Yay.
So Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Have a great weekend, of course, at the time of this recording. And with that being said, thank you guys so much for listening to another episode of Blind Level Tech. If you've got any questions or feedback for us at Aftersight, please let us know. Send an email to feedback@aftersight.org or send a voicemail to 720-712-8856. In any event, I have been your host, Evan Starnes, and I'm going to go jump off and get some coffee because I am running out of steam, and we will see you guys with fresh, refreshed brains and level heads next week.